Support comes from the Ohio State University Comprehensive Cancer Center, James Cancer Hospital, and Solove Research Institute. Just as no two people are exactly the same, neither are their cancers. At the OSU CCC James, there is no routine cancer. Learn more at cancer.osu.edu.
Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The 2022 midterms were supposed to be a Democratic wipeout. Conventional wisdom held that the party in the executive office suffers during off-year elections, which are the only measure, really, of voter approval outside of polling. But more than half of the nation's voting age population cast a ballot in November, in the second highest turnout for a congressional election year in two decades. And Republicans, especially those backed by former President Donald Trump, suffered defeat after defeat. The historic 52.2% turnout was a rare positive sign that Americans are engaged and will take the trouble to vote. Or was it? Today we consider American civics, where we stand and what we can do to get involved and make a difference at the ballot box. The Center for Civic Education in Los Angeles develops curricula for teachers and advocates for stronger civic education in the U.S. and emerging democracies. Donna Phillips is the Vice President and Chief Program Officer for the Center. Donna Phillips, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
How did the nation's founders think about civic engagement?
Well, this is something that we take up a lot within our program, so it's one of my favorite things to come back to. The story I always love to relate is, you know, at the end of the Constitutional Convention, after, you know, some long, hot weeks debating in Philadelphia, as Benjamin Franklin was leaving, someone asked him, you know, what kind of government have you given us? And he says, a republic, ma'am, if we can keep it. And that really kind of sets the tone for the type of government and what it would entail of its citizens. You know, a constitutional democracy, a republican form of government where we have representation always means that the citizens have to be actively engaged to keep it. And so it's not a passive government. It's not a passive role for citizens. So from its founding and everything leading to our revolution and our new constitution showed what civic engagement does, and that was what our founders and our framers were fighting for, the privilege to be able to shape our government and to self-govern. In our founding, in our very form of government, our founders and framers articulated that it would take an active, involved citizenry to be watchdogs on that.
But in his comment, as you said, Benjamin Franklin said, if we can keep it, even mm-hmm. then they worried about whether we're up to it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, again, from our founding, we also had factions and political divide. And even though, you know, George Washington warned against them in his farewell address before that, you know, James Madison in Federalist 10 articulates, almost preempting the argument that there's, you know, we're too diverse and too split and too factioned. But he kind of like undercuts that argument by saying, why, yes, you know, by nature of being human, we are always going to be in factions. We were always going to have varied interests. And the way we make use of that is not by denying them or trying to stop them, but you fight factions with factions, allow for the multiple perspectives to form. And then the hope is that over time, you know, a large enough coalition will put forth the common good and kind of sweep everyone else up into that. And that will continue to happen over time. But others rightfully were fearful of factions. And so even though they're human nature, you know, I think there was a concern that we were a nation too large and too diverse to be able to self-govern the way we put forward.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Today we're talking about what civics are, what civic responsibility is. A lot of people are arguing about it, you know, in Congress and in the Ohio General Assembly and states across the country about how to teach civics and what does it actually mean. My guest is Donna Phillips. She's Vice President and Chief Program Officer for the Center for Civic Education. It does exactly what it says. It advocates for stronger civic education and it helps develop education programs for civics. If you have a question or comment this hour, we're going to be talking about this in a larger sense with folks like Donna Phillips. We're also going to look at an effort coming out of Gahanna to unite much of Franklin County, not in any particular issue, but in the action of voting and participation. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So Donna Phillips, civic engagement, it's looked different over time. We know it's ebbed and flowed. You can look at the numbers. They've been keeping track of voting for decades now. But over time, over the course of the country, how has it changed?
So civic engagement, it's easily measured by looking at voter numbers, because that's a knowable statistic that we've been able to see. And as you mentioned at the start, we had record turnout in the past midterm election, and hopefully record turnout in 2020 with 62.8% voter turnout. It's always seemed crazy to me that in our country, you know, we celebrate something over 50%, when in other countries, you know, newer democracies, they have much higher turnout rates. But voting is just one way we look at civic engagement. We can look at civic engagement, you know, so we have these political moves, you know, contacting officials, participating in public forums, running for public office, supporting campaigns, the voting. And then, you know, other actions of civic engagement include, you know, more participatory community-based involvement, you know, like, you know, working to support people in need, volunteerism, you know, working to support a cause that's important to a community, and that kind of collective action too. So if we're sticking with more of the political piece of voter turnout and direct action within our political system, it has changed over time. I think national events and international events have also swayed what happens at the ballot box and voter turnout. When a popular or unpopular social issue is at stake on in referendum on state ballots, we see a large voter turnout to either vote up or down on a contentious social issue. We saw that with same-sex marriage. When that became, you know, and we saw record turnout in some states. So those are the kinds of things that have influenced it over time. I think the larger trend and the thing that my organization is most concerned about is what are the things that we can do prior to the voting age with students that's going to shape their dispositions, give them the skills and the knowledge, and then shape their dispositions to want to be involved, whether it's voting or all the other ways.
How do you do that when so many of the adults that they're associated with, so their parents, their relatives, their people around them, are so divided? And obviously we have the, you know, the antics, the dangerous, violent antics of January 6th to illustrate clearly that something's very, very wrong. How do you counteract that kind of stuff in the classroom?
That's a popular trend, is to export all of society's challenges back into the classroom. But that is really where our founders believed we needed to start, you know, that all education is civic education. So, you know, not just what happens in the social studies classroom, but what happens in that school building. You know, it's an embryonic democracy if we take advantage of it in that way. And so a lot of the contentiousness that we see outside of the school, you know, those are some of the dispositions and skills that can be shaped while in school. And again, not just in the social studies classroom, where you're also learning the content and the knowledge.
But now, Politicians are arguing about what is taught in schools. Now that's a bone of contention.
Yeah, that definitely adds. So social studies and civics have always been a contested field. So that's not new. You know, again, there's always going to be disagreements on what the common good is and the best way to get there. And that's just the nature of politics. And who benefits from maintaining the status quo and who benefits from pushing us forward. That's always going to be, you know, and because that's part of social studies and civics itself, it's always going to be contested. What we're seeing now is certainly unprecedented in terms of the actual legislation coming down and the direct impact it's having on standards and curriculum. But the contest itself is not new. And so teachers across the country and then working as a national organization, we've always had to navigate working with our state partners, you know, how they can continue to teach in civics and history and maintain their job. but, you know, I think at this moment, what we're lacking in general is dosage and actual civics courses and American history courses starting in elementary. So that to me is the first challenge and fight we have in our field. Now the day-to-day and what teachers are experiencing in different states and the restrictions and potential punishments and bans, that's very specific and personal and present. But in that same state, do they even start in kindergarten with civic and history education?
One of the issues that has popped up in Ohio, they want to recalibrate, I guess, political correctness or something to that effect on college campuses, yeah. State-funded college campuses and college and university campuses, and what teachers teach and how professors create balance in the classroom and all kinds of stuff. But research has shown that the real problem is between students. It's not a professor-led issue, but between students, they don't feel comfortable talking politics, talking about mm-hmm. these uncomfortable subjects. And I wonder about that and being able to learn to talk and take politics, you know, make politics something that's worth talking about. When did it become impolite to talk politics?
Yeah, that's a great question. I feel like, you know, my entire life we've been told not to talk politics or religion, you know.
At the cocktail party, right? Yeah.
Right. So, you know, politics is not a dirty word. It's simply, as I said before, it's looking at what the common good is. There's healthy debate over what that is and what's the best way to get there. And if you are beholden and believe that democracy is the best form of government, and you might be on one end of the spectrum as far as what that means and looks like versus the other end, but we're still in a system where we believe that the people have a say, that they have rights that are protected, that power is limited, and that we all have equal opportunity, right? We all agree to these democratic constitutional principles. And so the debate within that spectrum can and should be healthy. It's when we have people who don't believe that democracy is the best form of government because they don't understand what it is, because they missed all of their civic education to get to that point, that I think it gets very unhealthy. And you can't have a good conversation, even a contentious one, within a healthy realm. And that's also the problem we're seeking to fix.
Scores in U.S. history and civics for eighth graders are down across the country. That's according to the so-called Nation's Report Card. Everyone is concerned. What's your take on that?
Yeah, it's not surprising, given two things. The long federal policy, No Child Left Behind, that did not fund social studies or civic education for decades. That was something that, you know, every organization has been fighting in every state, you know, social studies team. And then the effects of the pandemic. So it was kind of a double whammy. Had we not had the pandemic, would the scores have dropped as much as they did? I mean, it was a level of significance that was worth noting. Mm-hmm. But it's not surprising because we've been fighting for so long, again, to get social studies.
Right.
Into
now we have kids in school whose parents weren't properly educated in civics and history. So there's a generational upon generational impact coming into play.
Absolutely.
Right. My guest is Donna Phillips. She's Vice President and Chief Program Officer for the Center for Civic Education. That's a Los Angeles-based nonprofit advocating for stronger civic education. We will return. If you want to join the conversation, what do you think civics education should look like? 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
The Last Ride, a deep dive into a shocking unsolved mystery.
These two young men disappear off the face of the earth, and the last person to see them live was this sheriff's deputy. His stories were so unbelievable.
Listen to the Last Ride podcast, part of the NPR network.
Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're looking at civic engagement and the future of democracy. When former President Trump and his followers repeatedly questioned the outcome of the 2020 presidential election, and as they continue to beat the drum of the big lie, even today, Americans across the country have wondered about the strength of our political system. They've wondered about the purpose and the legitimacy of our democracy. How could we go from believing the U.S., the epitome of electoral politics, to seeing armed mobs attack the Capitol and call for hanging the vice president? Still with us is Donna Phillips, Vice President and Chief Program Officer for the Center for Civic Education. It's a Los Angeles-based organization that develops lesson plans for teachers and advocates for stronger civic engagement and education in the U.S. and in emerging democracies. Ray Block Jr. is the Michael D. Rich Distinguished Chair for Countering Truth Decay at the Nonpartisan Rand Corporation and an Associate Professor of Political Science and African American Studies at Penn State. Welcome to the show.
It's great to be here.
You know, I had to smile when I said Countering Truth Decay. I usually don't put such long titles in, but that one really caught my attention, Ray Block. Thanks for joining us. You and your colleagues last fall surveyed thousands of U.S. residents about their views on the state of American democracy. You found that people are generally hopeful. How so?
So before I get started, I want to shout out my co-authors. And so Professor Andrine Wright and my graduate student, Mia Powell. It's important that my people get their shout outs here. And it's a Big Ten affair, basically. We have Penn State. My colleague and Andrine Wright will be joining University of Wisconsin. She'll be a Badger. So it's the Badgers, the Buckeyes, the Nittany Lions. Oh, my.
Right? Michigan State right here. Okay.
Okay, right. Go Spartans. Yeah, we're Big Ten in it, right?
You got it.
So I feel like we wrote this piece because we saw these two things that sit side by side that some people might think of as paradoxical, but we don't, right? On the one hand, it's pretty clear from the people we interviewed and surveyed that folks are scared about the state of democracy and the future of it. We actually phrased the question in a way that we thought it would be hard to agree with because we were so extreme in the way we described it. We essentially asked people whether or not they believe that democracy could fail within a decade or so. And folks were worried about that. So like more than 6 out of 10 people expressed that concern on the one hand, right? On the other hand, people went into the midterms with a strong sense of hope. And that hope sat side by side with everything that I just told you about this idea that we could lose democracy in the United States, coinciding with the idea that roughly 44% of the people in our survey said that going into the election, hope was the dominant emotion that showed up for him. And we think this ties together because I just generally have faith in our country to move forward. And admitting that there is a real problem with the state of affairs is the first step towards real solutions, towards getting towards these things. And so the thing that I think I want people to take away from this is that that combination of worry and hope is something that people are expressing in the responses to the questions we give them. And all of the co-author team are scholars of race and politics in the United States. And the worry and hope story is a very common story to people who study US race relations, because sentiments of worry and hope sort of get at some of the major themes that are explored by minority scholars in general and minority thinkers in general, and Black scholars and thinkers in particular.
Yeah, you found your research and your colleagues' research found that people of color are the most hopeful and that white Americans are the most worried about the future of American democracy. What do you make of that contrast?
So if I can be kind of philosophical here, if
Of
y'all
course,
allow me that, right?
absolutely.
There's a version of American exceptionalism that I think speaks to democracy in the United States and abroad. And the idea is that democracy here is so amazing and arguably better than democracy elsewhere because it endures, right? It's no guarantee that a country that starts off as a non-democracy and becomes a democracy stays a democracy. The United States has, by and large, taken that as a given. In other words, people who study comparatively what happens to non-democracies that democratize and ultimately start to backslide, we usually don't include ourselves in that conversation. I have colleagues of mine who study global politics who know this very well. I think that it was a big wake-up call to many Americans what happened on January 6th. And I think that wake-up call is that, okay, we may not be as exceptional as we think we are. I would say, as a person who studies race relations, the idea that America might not be perfect is something that a lot of scholars of color and social thinkers of colors know intimately well, but now everyone else does. And I think it's the collective understanding that not only can there be authoritarian pockets within our democracy, but that those pockets of authoritarianism can affect everyone. And I think that's the difference. Before, the concerns about authoritarianism spawning and building within a democracy were things that only certain people cared about because they were only relevant to the well-beings and day-to-day lives of certain people. I don't think any American now has the luxury of not paying attention to this stuff anymore. That may explain some of the racial differences we're seeing between the hope and worry dichotomy.
Yeah, Donna Phillips, what about January 6th? Any sense? I mean, did it change the pulse, of American civics?
Yeah, I mean, when January 6 riots took place, I was still in DC public schools, and I was leading our team in all of our hybrid and virtual learning construct, and we were watching it in real time during a meeting where we were putting together virtual lessons, for the teachers. And within that hour, we dismissed, and they all went back to say, I have to figure out what I'm teaching tomorrow.
Right.
And so, from a social studies lens, and my colleagues across the country in the social studies state teams, this now becomes the fabric of what we teach, and it's a new, just as you would teach the impact of the Civil War and what it did to our American democracy, and just as you would teach, the events of 9/11 and our response, these are pivotal things that fundamentally change our democratic story, and so it has truly impacted curriculum and civics.
I'm interested in both of your thoughts, and I'll start with you, Ray Block, on the idea that the victor writes the history. And the disparate views of January 6th that have come out right away. I mean, really, very quickly, this idea that they were just tourists who got rowdy in these the nation's capital kind of a thing. Who is the victor in that? Who's writing the history of January 6th, Ray?
I'm going to take it one step before that
Okay.
because January 6th happens because of election denialism.
Right.
And so I want to talk about election denialism, if it's okay,
Sure,
because I think
absolutely.
that what we found in our survey is that voting patterns reflect the story. That story could be this: people who campaigned on things that sounded like election denialism and extremism and things like that, they weren't as successful during the midterm elections. That's because people didn't put them into office, right? And I feel like that's an important point to make here. So, if the victor writes the history, right? the winners of elections are the people that are going to be positioned to do so. And I think voters spoke out during the midterm elections. I'm not saying that it was a one-to-one thing where all election deniers had bad nights, right, but many did. And I think the story we can tell from the data that we got from our survey is that they had bad nights because voters were rejecting that kind of thinking, because they didn't want people to be put into political positions where they could write the history in a different way.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Donna Phillips.
Yeah, I like that hopeful notion. You know, I like that you took us back to that point. What we focus on at the center is the Constitution and constitutional history and that deep constitutional learning. And so I would take the approach that the Constitution is the victor, and what was at stake was the Constitution. Here was a group of people who tried to disrupt a constitutional process that had taken place successfully, you know, for over 240 years, and they lost. And so it was a direct challenge to the very fabric of our constitutional. And so that to me, that, you know, that history writes itself. And that's sort of, you know, our organization has been asked, do you have any curriculum around January 6th? And it's sort of like, we have the Constitution, you know, and then in the hands of the teachers in the different states, that's where the learning takes place. And then I think, as you mentioned, Ray, the voters then spoke in reaction to that too.
You know how they give public service requirements to people who have been convicted of any number of crimes, right? And I thought, what if they gave them all a year-long intensive course in American civics and American history as not a punishment, but, you know, sort of as that public service act?
There is a state that did that.
Who?
And,
where?
And the course, I will have, I'll find it for you.
I'd love to know that.
And the course they gave them was Are We the People course.
Oh, okay.
Nice.
I'm 100% in favor of that. Everyone deserves it.
Because so much of it goes back to education. You know, I noticed, Ray Block, in the article that you and your colleagues wrote for The Conversation, that you referred to when you said you surveyed thousands of U.S. residents. You didn't say voters and you didn't say Americans. Was that intentional?
It was because our sample size encompassed people that were registered and who weren't registered. Okay. So we just wanted to cast a broader net.
Okay, yeah. Because so much focus is put on registered voters. And it seems to, there's often a lot of focus on that and not what that larger potential electorate thinks and feels. So on top of measuring hope and worry, you also asked if people were angry or proud. What did you make of that? The angry, proud thing with America, Ray Block?
So the hope emotions just really stuck out in comparison. But of course, people can feel many things at the same time, right? Mm-hmm. And anger was a small fraction of that feeling. And it's interesting because if you go across demographic categories, anger never made up more than 6% of the sample when it comes to people not like ticking that category of emotion, right? Pride, on the other hand, was pretty common, not as common, obviously, as worry and hope, right? But roughly 15s, like less than 20% at the most, were people who expressed the feeling of pride when they think about the country and when they think about the midterms and what's going to be happening going into them. I think what stuck out to us is that we expected the negative valence emotions to be the bigger ones, because that just seems like the temperature of the nation right now when you look at political rhetoric. And so we were shocked that hope beat those things out. In other words, hope won out over some of these other less positive emotions that show up in people's minds and hearts when they're thinking about the midterms.
You know, the whole pride thing, I wanted to, Donna Phillips, I was thinking about that when you were talking about Philadelphia and the Constitutional Convention. You know, and I think about, you know, if you've read, and I'm sure you have, Miracle in Philadelphia and the way it was written there and in many other places, these guys didn't, you know, it wasn't all about jingoistic pride. They were actually, it was nuts, you know, it was soup to nuts governance issues that they were dealing with. What role does this issue of exceptionalism, that we have to be so proud, that we have to be the best all the time, that we're the most wonderful, how does that conflict or dovetail with being a good civic, a member of our you know, civic society?
Yeah, I go back for a second to what I said before, which is there's always groups of people who benefit from maintaining the status quo, and those who benefit from moving it forward and moving progress. And when you think about our founding era, you know, and our Constitution and the many, many compromises made, and all of the groups not accounted for within the Constitution, you know, women, Indigenous populations, Black people, we had an enslaved population, you know, poor, certain religions, you know, so since that time, you know, a majority of our population has had to fight and overcome their disclusion from the beginning of our founding. And so, you know, just as a woman, I can have pride and have reflective patriotism for my country, a country that still denied my gender the right to vote until the 19th Amendment, and still, you know, in practice, you know, doesn't ensure pay equity, right? So I can still have pride and find America to be exceptional in ways that other democracies are not, and on the world stage, and still want to be critical and move it forward. And I think that reflective patriotism is where we want to be, not the blind American exceptionalism. We can love our country and our democracy for the hope that it gives us and the structures that it gives us to make change and always be more moving towards that more perfect union, and still activate our political processes to make those changes. That's my very hopeful take on where we can continue to grow.
And what do you think, Ray Block?
So this is a cliche, but love is a decision, right? And if we just really talk about this crudely, like love for the country versus not love for country, right? It's very easy during times that are difficult to forget that there has to be a commitment to the nation and to this experiment that we're running on democracy here. And that's where the pride stuff comes in. That's where the worry stuff comes in. And that's where the hope stuff comes in. I think that one of the challenges that we face, and this is one of the reasons why I'm really excited to be working at RAND to combat truth decay, is that narratives that present American democracy as a lesser option are out there, and they have the ability to take hold among those who are disillusioned because what they see does not necessarily feel good or look good to them, right? If you believe, like I do, that the American Creed has two things in it, it has this idea of what the country's about and a commitment to the country when it comes to maintaining its democracy. Maintaining its democracy is not always easy. And I think that the blinders are off now when it comes to how easy people think that maintaining democracy is. This isn't automatic. And I don't think it's a good idea to continue to stress test American democracy to see how resilient it is. It was made by people. It requires people to go, and people will determine whether or not we keep it.
Ray Block Jr., thanks so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Ray Block Jr. is a senior political scientist at the RAND Corporation and an associate professor of political science and African American studies at Penn State University. And he's also the Michael D. Rich Distinguished Chair for Countering Truth Decay at the RAND Corporation. Love that title. Thanks again for joining us. We'll be right back, continue our conversation about civics, how it plays out on the ground, and how one organization out of Gahanna here in Franklin County is working to spread the good word about democracy and getting the vote out. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
The Last Ride, a deep dive into a shocking unsolved mystery.
These two young men disappear off the face of the earth, and the last person to see them live was this sheriff's deputy. His stories were so unbelievable.
Listen to The Last Ride podcast, part of the NPR network.
I'm your host, Dan Fisher. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Dan Fisher. We're talking about civics, the frailty of American democracy, and how awareness and education are fundamental to saving the system. Still with us is Donna Phillips, Vice President and Chief Program Officer for the Center for Civic Education. That's an organization that develops lesson plans for teachers and advocates for stronger civic education in the U.S. and emerging democracies. The Gahanna Foundation on July 4th will launch a new public awareness campaign focused on boosting voter registration and voter turnout in all elections across 15 cities in Franklin County. John Michael Spinelli is the president of the Gahanna Foundation. Welcome to the show.
Good morning, Ann.
So you're calling this Democracy Challenge 2023. What's the challenge?
The challenge is for the 15 cities in Franklin County that we did voter turnout research for that went back to 2011 is for us to sort of look at them as sports teams. You know, we love sports. Everybody loves sports. The Bengals, the Buckeyes, everything. We have athletes. We slice and dice them on how they can throw and run and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, the one thing we don't compete with is democracy. We compete in academics, in sports, in who can have the best cupcakes or barbecue, but we don't compete in democracy. So last year, we did a research of 15 cities in Franklin County, and maybe for the first time ever, we actually sort of ranked them based on their voter turnout percentage. And we got to look at it, and we thought, hey, we have a league. It's called Franklin County, and we have 15 teams in it, and they're the cities. And we ranked them according to their voter turnout percentage. And, you know, we had a winner, and we had a loser, and we had a whole bunch of people in between. And we thought, hey, this is fun. Let's treat it like sports, because voter turnout has been pretty bad, as we saw last year. Statewide, the voter turnout in Ohio was 51%, not good. In Franklin
County,
that's
actually pretty good.
No. 50% of people didn't bother to vote that were registered
to vote. That's not typical in that it is higher than normal.
Even the highest, Upper Arlington, is 64%. We think that's flunking democracy.
Okay.
We're saying, hey, we can do much, much better.
All right. So, Donna Phillips, what do you make of a project like this?
Well, I love the positive incentive to vote, and gamifying it, incentivizing it is a great idea. The other strategy used by whole nations is to penalize non-voting. You know, you pay a fine like they do in Australia or Italy if you don't vote. So they have got really high voter turnout. My question is, when you incentivize it, does that also compel them to become better informed prior to voting? Because that's the other debate we have, compulsory voting, but are they as informed as those who show up and vote, even in lower percentages?
Yeah, John Michael Spinelli, what about that?
Well, you know, I'm glad you had Donna Phillips on today. I didn't know she was going to be on with me. But the great thing about this, confluence of her and me is that I'm on Twitter, where the foundation has a handle on Twitter. And, you know, over the past couple months, Donna, I have discovered your 60-Second Civics Project.
And
I am
wonderful.
So excited about that. And I contacted your PR person, and I asked for permission to use your 60-Second Civics segments in our halftime show on July 4th in Gahanna, and I got permission to do that. So, you're giving the Gahanna Foundation permission to use your 60-Second Civics.
Tell me the 60-Second Civics, Donna Phillips. What is that?
So it's the daily podcast of the Center for Civic Education. We have over 4,000 episodes since we've started it. Every day there's a new episode just highlighting some constitutional foundational topic or an issue. We do special series. We do things for, you know, different months and times of the year. And so teachers use them, organizations use them. There's a quiz, and then there's a transcript and discussion points that you can use to launch afterwards.
We'll post a link to that on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Gail in Clintonville, you're on the air. Hi, Gail.
Hey, Ann. First of all, I want to commend you for bringing such thoughtful and important subjects to the radio in the morning. I mean, you are a treasure, so I'm really going to miss you.
Oh, thank you.
So, thank you. When you made the comment to the woman about the that's on your show about mm-hmm. the civics, mm-hmm. and you said something to the effect that a lot of the parents never had civics that much, and so it's, you know, they're not passing that information on to their kids, and so that's part of the discontent, I think. Hmm. My other statement is I was born just after World War II, and so seniors, that's one of the reasons, because we have historical memory. We remember what happened during World War II. We remember what dictators look like, and that's why seniors are the most active voting populace. Because we remember, we have a historical memory of what can happen if you get a dictator right. like Trump, et cetera, in power. He wants to get rid of the Constitution, for God's sake.
Well,
you know,
Gail,
so,
yeah. Well, yeah. I think it's interesting because that also brings up the issue of, you know, knowing your history lessons, and that's another thing that the scores are down on. What about that, Michael Spinelli?
The history aspect of it.
Yeah.
Well, our part of our halftime show at Red, White, and Blues is going to be driven by our high school students. We now have high school students from Gahanna and New Albany, and they are reaching out to their peers at hopefully 13 other high schools in Franklin County that are high schools that are in our 15 cities that mm-hmm. we looked at. And one of the things we're going to do this year is we're going to TikTok the vote. And, you know, you and I are old enough, the caller.
Before they banned TikTok, you mean?
The more people's hair is on fire, the more I want to use TikTok. You know, I was born in 1948 as well. So I'm a early boomer, which is sort of a derogatory term among some millennials these days. Anyway, we're old enough to remember Rock the Vote. Mm-hmm. Well, Rock the Vote didn't rock the vote. And we can see in voter turnout that it didn't rock the vote. So we're going to TikTok the vote.
That's interesting. I'm glad you brought that up. And Gail, thanks a lot for that call. I really appreciate it. And thanks for those kind words. Donna Phillips, can you talk a little bit about how to use and how not to use social media in all of this? Because we know social media has played a huge role, and the internet has played a huge role in how people think about what voting is and what the mm-hmm. issues are.
Yeah, and I think since its inception of the different social media platforms, there's definitely been an evolution of how it's used and how effectively it's used. I just remember, I'm old enough to remember Rock the Vote. There were TV commercials, you know, and it was really exciting. I don't know that watching those made me want to vote, but schools could adopt the Rock the Vote program. And then what that did is it allowed, elementary and middle school age and high school age kids to have a simulated election. And we looked at ballots and we read about the candidates, and then actually our results were sent into a central place. So we saw how we voted compared to others across the nation, and being able to simulate the actual process in school. I think research shows that that is a huge disposition forming thing. And students who do simulations like that, democratic simulations in school, are more likely to perform the actual democratic and political acts outside. So social media, definitely, you know, media, and then social media can play a role. But I think the programs have to come inside the school building for it to take hold on the students' ultimate actions.
What do you think, Gemma Spinelli?
Hey, students are going to drive the next generation, the 18-year-olds and plus. If they all voted, they're the largest voting bloc in the United States. They can control the future. The voter turnout percentage in Ohio last November was 21%. We think that's pretty bad. So hopefully civics, well, the slogan of the Gahanna Foundation is, where civic minds fashion the future. Hmm. Civics is sort of an underplayed, secondhand, thirdhand topic now, and we're trying to elevate it.
You know, I'm wondering what you two think about the trend of moving voters, either closing schools on voting day or moving the voting places, out of schools. I remember growing up and you'd see all these adults lined up to vote and it felt kind of sacred. It felt like, wow. And we'd walk by in our little lines in and out of recess or wherever we were going. And I just thought that looked pretty cool and was something I wanted to do. Donna Phillips, I mean, we're separating ourselves, and I know there's all kinds of safety issues and blah, blah, blah. I get all of that. But kids just, you know, now people take their kids with them to vote, but I think that's different than seeing it in school like that.
Yeah, and state by state, it's different. In D.C., the schools stay open, and they are the polling places. But in Maryland, they were not. We closed schools, and so to your point, you know, sometimes my parents took me to vote and other times they didn't. Sometimes we volunteered, you know, during the polls. But the first time I saw it in D.C., and I was like, wow, the kids can actually witness this. I think that is sacred and cool. It's a logistical challenge for sure. There are some state laws that don't allow you to take your child into the voting booth, you know, above a certain age. And in Maryland, we fought to just say up until the age of 17, you know, why would you deprive an almost voter of being there firsthand to witness how to do it? So the more exposure, the better.
What do you think, John Spinelli?
Well, let me throw out a little shout out to the Ohio Association of Student Leaders. They're a statewide group. And one of their board members is a student council advisor and a history teacher at the New Albany High School. And we're excited to partner with them because, frankly, Ann, if we can pull D.C. 23 off in Franklin County, we can pull it off in Ohio's 88 counties, and we can pull it off nationwide. So, Donna, maybe we'll come to Los Angeles, and we'll have L.A. County compete against Cuyahoga County and Franklin County, and we'll put up the scoreboard, which is the voter turnout percentage. And you know what? Too bad we can't bring FanDuel into this and bet on outcomes and actually
they
make
might
some
think,
money.
They'll probably think about it. Let's see. Dwight, Dwight in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Dwight.
Hi, Ann. I wanted to do a shout-out to Donna. She and I served together on the Council for Social Studies State Supervisor Specialist for many years. I was with
what's
the
your last name, Dwight? She's, you know, you're killing her.
Oh, Gross.
Oh, Dwight Gross.
From the High Department of Education.
Okay.
Hi, Dwight.
Okay. Hey, hi, Donna. You know, Ann had kind of referenced this about the importance of voting. There are some programs around the country, including Central Ohio, called Kids Voting, and it's Kids Voting Ohio, where students actually learn about the issues, and they go and actually with their parents and get to vote at the polls on their own special ballots, and then they tabulate that. That's one way that I think is important. But Donna talked about it earlier. The bottom line to this is a strong social studies education, period. And what Donna referenced earlier was the marginalization of social studies, especially in the elementary areas, and mainly because of testing of reading and math. And the emphasis on those two areas is what is reflected in the school scores. So they want their students to do very well, but the consequence of that is social studies is not being taught as it should. And I think that's the bottom line problem to all this. If we want to have people civically engaged, we have to have modeling of that within the schools, but we have to have a rich social studies education as well.
Thank you, Dwight. Thanks for that call. John Spinelli, what do you think?
Well, a little walk down memory lane for Dwight. In about 2001, I was the Columbus coordinator for Kids Voting under Suzanne Coyle at the time, and I wrote a grant to the Columbus Foundation that got us funded for 3 years. So, my roots go deep into
civic. Do you think that kind of thing matters, though?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Of course. Kids Voting. I mean, the premise of Kids Voting was when parents went to vote, they took their kids with them because parents want to do what their adults do. And if they see them voting, then maybe somewhere along the line it instills upon them that this is an important thing. This is how we make a decision in America. We're not an authoritarian operation yet. And, you know, we get to vote twice maybe a year in a public election. Obviously, we don't sit on private boards and we can't vote. But, you know, when we vote, we make public policy. Whether your school system gets to have a bond issue, Gahanna is going to spend $213 million to rebuild its school system. I don't have kids in the system, but I pay my property taxes. Mm-hmm. And because my background is economic development, I understand the direct relationship between property values and good school systems.
You know, we have less than, just like 30 seconds, Donna Phillips. So I wanted you to talk a little bit more about that local piece in voting. People turn out for the big presidential elections. It matters, of course. But what about those smaller ones?
Like they say, all politics is local. And I think organizations that can bring that home, in the community are very important. Our Project Citizen program for We the People does exactly that as well. It allows students to learn how to make a difference in their community through public policy solutions. And that in turn will shape a disposition to continue to think about their community and then vote in local elections.
Donna Phillips, Vice President and Chief Program Officer for the Center for Civic Education. Thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
I loved being here. Thank you, Ann.
You bet. And John Michael Spinelli, President of the Gahanna Foundation. We and the program to...
Democracy Challenge 2023.
DC 2023. Apologies. Thanks for your time today, too. We'll post a link to your website at
WOSU.org/allsides. So you saved the best for last.
Thanks. Okay. Thanks a lot. And thanks to everybody else for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.